Why? Despite so much seeming progress along so many traditional indicators, is there quite so much discontent? So I can safely say that as an adult living in Britain, I've never experienced a good economy on a sustained basis. I don't really know what it feels like to live in a good economy. The great financial crisis hit just as I first began studying A-level economics. As people queued outside the Bank Northern Rock in early 2007, my economics tutor commented that the recession was a horrible thing, but that it was a good time to study economics. Well, the subsequent decade and a half has proved to be a very good time to study economics. From the Great Recession to austerity to Brexit to the pandemic and its fallout, we've lurched from crisis to crisis as living standards seem to have fallen for the average person. The Great Recession saw the UK economy shrink 6% between 2008 and 2009. Unemployment peaked to its highest level since 1995. Many businesses went bust, including my stepdad's. And this story was similar across the Western world. Global GDP and unemployment suffered, just as they did in the UK. But even this terrible event would seem mild compared to what was to come. Following the financial crisis, many governments across the Western world pursued austerity policies, hoping to balance the government budget. In my opinion, this was a case of misdiagnosis and misdirection. The crisis had led to the collapse of tax revenues and rise in unemployment benefits that accompanies any recession. That explained the budget imbalance. The economy was growing, actually, and the deficit was falling even before the first serious cuts hit in 2011. And besides, austerity did not even achieve its stated aims of reducing the debt. Years on, then-Chancellor George Osborne was forced to admit that he had missed his original targets. In 2010, Osborne urged us to fix the roof while the sun was shining. But his cuts to schools resulted not only in stunted growth among school children in the UK, but also led to the collapse of an actual roof in a school in Kent, as well as the roofs of many other schools and hospitals across the country. Never before has a metaphor come back to bite someone so hard. We've become so used to poor economic performance in this country that it's easy to forget that we ever used to expect or even demand high growth. Historically, it was thought that recessions would be followed by rapid recoveries to make up for lost time. Instead, it took 5 years for UK GDP to reach the level it was before the Great Recession. In the decade leading up to the pandemic, GDP growth was about 2% a year, or only about 1% on a per capita basis. Although other G7 economies were having their own problems, we typically did even worse. It has been said that we in the UK inhabit what's called a doom loop of growth, low growth leading to higher debt and to cuts, to further stagnation, and so on. We lag behind other rich countries in our investment levels. Real wages fell for 6 straight years during the coalition government, and even today are only modestly above where they were pre-crisis. As the Institute for Fiscal Studies put it, this lack of growth in real wages is unprecedented in the last 200 years of British economic history. There has been no longer period without growth in real wages since the Napoleonic Wars. If you know the Institute for Fiscal Studies, they're really not prone to hyperbole. Of course, money isn't everything, but it's not like our low GDP growth was a result of prioritising other things that matter. In 2022, the Bennett Institute of Cambridge University showed that England lags behind Europe in basic physical and social infrastructure, with the availability of things like public transport, GP practices, cash machines, post offices, museums and chemists, among other things, declining across almost all English regions. And it's not like we've prioritised the poor either. Earlier this year, Joseph Rowntree Foundation released a report showing that the bottom 40% of UK earners have lost out since the pandemic and will be even worse off by 2029. Economics is synonymous with tough love and making difficult choices, as if what's good for the economy can't be good for the people. For instance, in 2017, Dominic Raab, the UK First Secretary of State at the time, responded to a woman criticising cuts to disability benefits by saying, I can think of lots of things that I would like to avoid making difficult decisions on, and lots of areas like the health service or schools that I want to put even more money in. But unless you've got a strong economy creating the revenue, it's just a childish wish list. The truth is that cutting spending on health and schools amounts to shooting oneself in the foot economically, while unnecessarily making the lives of sick people and children much worse in the process. One report found that ill health was costing the UK population around £2,200 in annual earnings because people were leaving jobs, working fewer hours, and had higher health costs. For context, £2,200 is around 7% of average income in the UK, a pay rise that's nothing to be sniffed at. Even if your aim is like Raab's, having a strong economy creating the revenue, low income and unemployment mean more spent on benefits and less taken in taxes as people languish in either poorly paid jobs or no jobs at all. Skimping on health can also amplify costs down the line. You fail to treat an infection and then end up having a limb removed. Evidence shows that as preventative care has been cut in the UK, spending on crisis care has risen. Spending actively on things like reducing smoking and alcoholism, promoting safe sex, encouraging breastfeeding, tends to reduce the healthcare people need in the long term. According to the World Health Organization, spending more on mental health too should return the investment fourfold over time. Yet because of underfunding, doctors and nurses are stuck removing metaphorical limbs down the line. This is why £200 million in cuts to local public health budgets in the UK ended up costing £1 billion later on. These realities are not confined to rich countries like the UK. Rwanda, for example, suffered from one of the worst genocides in recorded history in 1994, with 1 million people losing their lives. The long-term consequences of this included a spread of sexually transmitted infections from widespread rape during the war, as well as an outbreak of deadly diseases such as cholera. Following this tragedy, Rwanda decided to invest heavily in healthcare, with the prevalence of deadly diseases like HIV dropping dramatically, while the economy also boomed, and they even paid off their public debt. Even in unimaginably horrible circumstances, and perhaps especially in unimaginably horrible circumstances, investing in basic human needs is the best path forward. This is the path that we have chosen to forego. In a nutshell, this is why we are getting poorer. Across the global economy, people are much poorer than they could be and than they reasonably should be. Time and time again, the perverse dynamics of the economy have led to situations where there's money on the table. Things could be improved drastically if our economy were better designed. Many people are feeling the pinch as life seems to get harder rather than easier. Long-held expectations about progress are dashed, and people start to question whether the dominant economic indicators even matter anymore. Our economy suffers from two major shortcomings as I see it. Firstly, it is uneven. From the rise of billionaires and their seemingly unlimited influence at the top, to areas which are economically left behind at the bottom, we fail to rein in the rich and powerful in order to benefit those who are struggling. Secondly, the economy is dysfunctional. It simply fails to work properly, and this has a negative impact on everyone, rich and poor alike. For example, if you name a country, I'll name a country that is regularly talking about its housing crisis. One 2023 report found that out of 94 housing markets across the world, the number that were deemed unaffordable was 94. Yes. From the extortionate rents in London and Manhattan to the shanty towns of South Africa to the favelas of Brazil, housing seems to be a source of disquiet everywhere. Our uneven and dysfunctional economy is not delivering for the average person. So this narrative of getting poorer, I think, puts me into direct opposition with authors like Steven Pinker and Hans Rosling. When I wrote this, I didn't realize Steven Pinker would be here. I don't think he's actually here to defend himself, but he's somewhere. Anyway, they've argued that the world has been getting better, but people don't realize it. Chapter 4 of my book goes into a lot of detail about the so-called new optimist narrative and the statistics used to support it. So the first thing I want to acknowledge is that, look, the world is not amenable to simplistic narratives. It's not the case that everything has been getting worse along every dimension, and that's an absurd proposition, and my book isn't about that. An example is that much of humanity's history saw most children not surviving into adulthood. Now even people in poorer countries can assume that their children will live past the age of 5. Many curable diseases have been vaccinated against, and issues of basic health, nutrition, and education do yet genuinely seem to be getting better. Although there is now one caveat to that, which we will discuss later. There are also several clear-cut success stories in the global economy. Countries such as China, South Korea, and Japan have catapulted up the economic ladder since World War II. There are other countries, including Rwanda, which seem to hold some promise of repeating this feat. These are just a few of the changes that have happened over my lifetime that are cause for celebration. In my opinion, the question the New Optimist authors failed to take seriously is this. Why? Despite so much seeming progress along so many traditional indicators, is there quite so much discontent? Pinker in particular resorts to blaming cognitive biases and the media in his book Enlightenment Now. And I'm a behavioral economist. I study human biases for a living. It really bothers me when people use behavioral economics to argue that everyone else is irrational and biased and that they're right. I think if you're doing behavioral economics like that, you're doing it wrong. There are like 200 biases listed on Wikipedia. Some of them contradict each other. Some of them aren't real. They're just from some really weird experiment. Like, you really need to be careful about which bias applies and when. As an illustrative example, Steven Pinker says that people are prone to something called negativity bias, which I think you can probably guess the meaning of, right? This may be true in some circumstances, but the problem is that there's a bias for everything, including the exact opposite, optimism bias. People are hardwired to be optimistic, and there's actually more research into this than most biases. It's one of the more robust biases. Pinker's book was released in 2018, and to be honest, I think that's a case in point. To be fair to Hans Rosling, his book was released a year earlier, Factfulness, and he did finish by warning about a pandemic. So, I want to get a little bit more into progress in poverty and inequality, which is one of the big things that New Optimists talk about. The $2.15 per day international poverty line, some of you may have seen this graph, shows poverty going like that over the past few decades or century. So according to this metric, we've gone from having 90% of the world in poverty centuries ago to 90% of the world out of poverty today, with plenty of progress in the past few decades alone. This historically unprecedented decline in poverty is often shared as an example of the triumphs of the system we live under now. It is frequently used as a warning not to rock the boat too much. There are many critiques of this approach, and I'm happy to go into more detail in the Q&A, but the headline for me, is that $2.15 a day is just too little to be a feasible poverty line. If you express this poverty line as an annual income, it comes to $784.75 a year, which is an unimaginably small sum for basically everybody here, I can imagine. Any poverty line worth its salt should be based on a sober assessment of whether humans have access to our basic needs, food, water, shelter, but the $2.15 a day line, it might surprise you to know, is not. It was very much cobbled together by people at the World Bank based on what was available, not on what matters. Many scholars have advised a higher line, with suggestions ranging from $5.50 a day to $15 a day. $15 a day is still only $5,475 a year. Probably under $5,000 in the UK. Someone earning that much without any support is likely to be homeless. But they'd be classed as not in poverty by the international line. This points to an intrinsic problem that I want to try and hammer home, because I do, again, think it's something that New Optimists don't really consider. Using one poverty line for every country really fails to take into account what poverty actually looks like in context. You generally need to capture what it means to get by in a given location at a given time. You can do that in a few different ways. You can estimate it directly. People often use a percentage of the average income in a location. What it means to be in poverty changes. Internet access didn't even used to be a thing, right? But good luck getting by with it now. Housing needs are far more pressing in colder climates. In Finland, being without a roof and four walls means almost certain death, especially in winter. In Barbados, it is both safe and socially acceptable to sleep on a hammock next to the beach. Scholars who live in or have visited countries around the globe have commented that these numbers do not pass the laugh test. Egypt is down as having 1% poverty, yet its own government, having observed the large numbers of people who scrape by in slums in precarious employment, puts the figure at about one-third of the population. Something similar applies in Turkey. India is often billed as a rising star where the statistics on poverty and health have improved. This isn't entirely false. India has grown in recent years and boasts many achievements, including impressive universities and their successful satellite mission to Mars. Yet even before the pandemic, false optimism hid the truth about India. Far from being in advanced tech, as stereotypes might suggest, 9 out of 10 jobs created in India between 1991 and 2019 were informal, casual, irregular employment. Think pedicabs that transport tourists around Delhi. Stats from the World Bank imply that virtually every household in rural India has a personal toilet, which anyone who has even a passing familiarity with the country will recognise as absurd. A report released earlier this year concluded that 1 billion Indians have no disposable income, a number that has been stagnant for a long time. India's recovery since the pandemic has taken what's called a K shape. While the rich get richer, but the poor get poorer. It's okay, there you go. The top 10% of earners in India now receive over half of national income, up from a third in 1990, while the bottom half receive only 15% of national income, down from 22% in 1990. India's middle class have been squeezed, facing flat nominal wages and therefore seeing their earnings halve in real terms over the post-pandemic inflation. Savings have been run down while borrowing has risen. Meanwhile, those at the top have been spending in an expanding market for luxury items. After my dad read this book, he goes to me, it's not really about everyone getting poorer, is it? It's about most people getting poorer while some people get much richer, right? The K-shaped recovery in India, I think, illustrates that perfectly. So, the picture in India will also resonate with Latin Americans who have long struggled to escape the trap of being middle income but highly unequal and not fully industrialized. Many famous images of absolute poverty alongside outright opulence come from Latin America. Analyst Alex Hochuli coined the term Brazilianization to mean modern but not modern enough, facing relative stagnation in an economy which is nowhere near on track to joining the ranks of the rich countries. Hochuli notes that Brazil's entrenched elite, living in luxurious fortresses with advanced private security, actually benefit from this lack of development because it means they get to keep their housemates. The idea of Brazilianization may give us some clue as to what is happening elsewhere, including in the West. Brazil, of course, has a number of enviable features. It has an extremely enviable culture in terms of comparisons to the UK. I think it beats us on food, weather, and football, at least. But no scholar of the country would deny the picture painted by Hochuli. And I quote, "The West's involution finds its mirror image in the original country of the future, the nation doomed forever to remain the country of the future, the one that never reaches its destination, Brazil. The Brazilianization of the world is our encounter with a future denied, and in which frustration has become constitutive of our social reality. Welcome to Brazil. Here, the only people satisfied with their situation are financial elites and venal politicians. Everyone complains, but everyone shrugs their shoulders. This slow degradation of society is not so much a runaway train, but more of a jittery roller coaster, occasionally holding out the promise of ascent, yet never breaking free from the tracks. We always come back to where we started, shaken and disoriented, haunted by what might have been." Tell me he's not describing the premiership of Keir Starmer. Our final illustrative example comes from across the Atlantic Ocean. Economic performance in the USA makes for a striking contrast to the UK, and 1 year ago may even have seemed grounds for optimism. Barack Obama invested in a sizable economic stimulus, expanded healthcare.
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.